hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the October term of court of the South Dakota Supreme Court held here at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. We have a number of publications which are available in the lobby if you already haven't picked them up. They're available at no cost. The tan-colored one is a brief synopsis of the 9 oral argument cases we will be hearing this term. It also gives you a brief biographies of the justices. Help yourselves. Secondly, the blue-covered book is a narrative of how the judicial system in South Dakota works. And the third one, the gray-covered book with a picture on the cover, is a pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. And if you did not have an opportunity to pick one up before you came in, they'll be available in the lobby during the breaks. The first case for oral argument this morning is in the matter of JDMC, where the appellant father is Mr. William Janklow, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and Mr. Gordon Nielsen, an attorney from Sisseton. For the Sisseton Wahpeton Wate is Ms. Karen Gangle, trial prosecutor from Agency Village, and Mr. Andrew M. Small, an attorney from Minneapolis. And for the intervener appellee mothers, Ms. Danielle Doherty, an attorney from Aberdeen. Mr. Janklow, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and members of the court. May it please the court. For convenience purposes, we're going to refer to our client as the father. We're going to refer to Barbara Carlson as the mother, and we will refer to the deceased child and the child as we talk about the four individuals that are involved in this action. If I could start off, members of the court, I'd like to just cite a quote from the Dakota case, which was a case that involved the Sisseton area where the Clyde claimed a reservation. And the U.S. Supreme Court said the state court has jurisdiction over conduct on non-Indian land. That happened to also be a foster care case where the state was alleging jurisdiction and the tribe was alleging jurisdiction several decades ago. And that's really the seminal case around which we work with respect to this particular case. The facts in this case are laid out in the briefs, and they're not subject to a lot of dispute. But there are a couple key things that I would like to bring to the court's attention. There is no dispute that the father is a non-Indian and the mother is a Native American. The mother is an enrolled member of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. The children in question in this case are enrolled members of the Sisseton Wahpeton Oyate. And there's no dispute that the mother began to live with the father back around 1997-1998. She lived with the father and they had a child. The child is the subject of this action in 1999. In the year 2000, the mother decided she wanted to join the Air Force. And so the mother, when she was joining the Air Force required that she sign legal custody to the father. And at that time, they had been living together, the mother and father had been living together since 1997-1998. And for all times relevant in these proceedings, until they were divorced, these parties lived together. The mother signed a legal consent before the state court, had a state court action to give the custody of the father. At that point in time, the mother went into the Air Force. After boot camp, the mother and father married and moved to Biloxi, Mississippi. Another child, the deceased child, was born as a result of this marriage. The mother and father went to state court after they became married and agreed to nullify the old custody order. And so then in 2005, last year in January, February, the parties were divorced. In that divorce proceeding, they both received joint custody of the two children that are the subject of these proceedings. They both had joint custody. The arrangement was the father had the custody of these children throughout the school year, basically, with some minor modification, and the mother would have them during the course of the summer. There's no dispute. All the parties and the courts agree that during the relative times of this action, the child was living with the father, resided with the father, in Sisseton and not on trust ground. The testimony is undisputed. The father has never lived on trust ground. The mother has never lived on trust ground since 1997, 1998. The children have never lived on trust ground. So
Mr. Janklow, the whole family could have resided in Sioux Falls as well as in the Sisseton area.
Your Honor, the whole family lived in Biloxi, Mississippi in this case. The mother and father lived in Aberdeen, and yes, sir, the whole family could have lived in Sioux Falls. It just so happens they're close to Indian Trust Brown as they lived in Sisseton, but there's no dispute the father and that child have never lived on Indian Trust Brown, and the mother hasn't since she left the father.
Is there any legal distinction then that they live close to trust property?
I'm not aware, Your Honor, of any case. The only case I know of where it talks about close to trust property is a U.S. Supreme Court decision, Ruiz versus Morton, from years ago, where they said that Indian children, if they live on or near an Indian reservation, are allowed to have Indian health services benefits. That has nothing to do with a tribe or tribal relationship. But the Sisseton tribe claims jurisdiction in its ordinances over this child off the Indian country. We call it a reservation, Your Honor, but since the Dakota decision, there is no reservation. There's no recognition of a reservation. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled this reservation ceased to exist back in the 1800s when their reservation was sold off and restored to the public domain. If I can, I'm going to run through specific things that are really the subject of this controversy. One of them is an agreement that's laid out in the appellant's brief. It's not part of the settled record, but it's part of the appellant's brief, and we're glad it's there. It's in the tribal brief, and we're glad it's there because it really puts into perspective what this agreement is about. When you look at it, the tribal court and the appellees, the mother and the tribe, both claim that this is a grant of jurisdiction under the Indian Child Welfare Act to the tribe. That's nonsense. All you have to do is read it. And this court can read it, and you can make your own decision. There's no testimony as to how to interpret this. You read the four corners of the document. One, it's an agreement for purchase of services. Two, it isn't even an intergovernmental, it's not even a 126 contract under our law. It's an agreement for purchase of services. Two, the tribe is referred to as a provider under this contract. Three, the word ICWA never appears in it. Indian Child Welfare Act never appears in the four corners of this document, any case in its many pages. It's a contract that deals with the Code of Federal Relations and the Child Protection Services that the state of South Dakota is required to carry on under the Social Security Act. The third thing is, under ICWA, contracts have to have a 180-day period with notice before you can terminate them. This contract, by its terms, says it can be terminated on 30 days' notice without any requirement for either party to give a reason. In addition to that, when it talks about the description of services, and everybody hangs their hat on this on the other side, all child protection services performed by the state will be performed by the provider within the territory of the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oate to all eligible clients, members of the tribe, children eligible for membership in the tribe, and their legal custodians, children not eligible for enrollment who are Title IV eligible and who are within the jurisdiction, providers, tribal court, and legal custody, and any other individuals upon request of the state. That part's left out of the opponent's briefs. It says in this that the tribe is an independent contractor. They're not doing this as a government. They're doing it as a contractee, just like the state contracts with Lutheran Social Services at times to perform functions. The state contracts with county and city governments to carry on some of the state functions. The state contracts with other providers, with Our Home in Huron, and with various organizations like that. That's all this is a contract for services. But in addition to that, it's got to be audited according to state law. But the court of venue provision on A5, it's a right in the hand. The provider will utilize the tribal court of the Sisseton, Wahpeton, Oyate, or other court of competent jurisdiction. Now that's left out of opponent's brief. They don't remind the court. And had they used the court of competent jurisdiction, we wouldn't be here today. This is not an Indian Child Welfare case. It's not an ICWA case. When you look at the ICWA statute, first of all, ICWA is a constraint on a state government. It's not a grant of anything to a tribe. And all the commentators and all the congressional record says that. So do the cases. If we look at 1911A, which is the first provision, It only applies for children who are domiciled or resident on the reservation. Those are the only two conditions. In addition, as to where they live, they have to be domiciled or resident on the reservation. One, the trial court found and the tribal court found, and nobody's ever disputed, these children lived with their father during all the operative times with respect to this action. Second of all, ICWA will apply if they're a ward of the tribal court. And the tribal court and the opponent counsel go to great lengths to try and point out that they're wards of the court. They are wards of the court, allegedly, but after the proceedings were brought where they claim ICWA. And this court has held, our court has held, and so do other courts. ICWA applies as of the date. If ICWA applies, it's as of the date the pleadings are filed. It's not as the date that first they can give wardship and then claim, well, now it's an ICWA case. Second of all, if you look at Section B
Counsel, though, why couldn't the tribal court do both simultaneously? Why couldn't the tribal court take jurisdiction and declare a child a ward of the tribal court at the same time?
Well, except I'm just relying on our Supreme Court's case that has said, and I won't argue you couldn't, but our Supreme Court has said, ICWA applies or doesn't apply as of the time when the pleadings are filed. And the pleadings were filed in this case before the tribal court declared that this was a ward of the tribe. With respect to Section B, and there's a lot of stuff in the briefs about Section B, it's irrelevant. Section B says, in any state court proceeding for foster care placement or termination, etc., this isn't a state court proceeding. We're here appealing a decision of a state court only because of what a state court did with respect to a tribal court order. We're not here as a result of any state court action where the state court is dealing with the foster care placement or the termination of a child. And in addition to that, Section B specifically says if either parent objects, it can't go to tribal court. And our client testified when given the opportunity. He objected to this being in the tribal court. But even though he did that, it's irrelevant because it's not a B. This isn't a state court action where they transferred something to the tribe. This is a tribal action where they're trying to tell the state court now B applies. With respect to the tribal court went to great lengths to talk about the consensual relationship. They somehow feel that there's a Montana case here, an exception to the Montana case. Montana is very clear. The U.S. Supreme Court case in Montana. Montana only applies to on-reservation conduct. And they say as a general proposition, you have no jurisdiction tribes over non-Indians within a reservation. However, there are two exceptions. We weren't on a reservation. We weren't in Indian country under the definition of 1151. Or under the definition of Indian country or reservation within the purview of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Nothing that's before you today took place within the boundaries of any trust ground or any ground owned by an individual Indian held in trust or any ground owned by the tribal government in or out of trust. No action involved in any of this. This is no different, members of the court, than if the mother she's stationed at an Air Force base in North Dakota. If the mother were to sit in North Dakota, all these operative facts that happened in South Dakota, the child's living with the father in South Dakota, the father's never been in North Dakota, and the mother brings an action against the father up in North Dakota. If they did, at the least they would apply conflicts laws, and at the best they wouldn't take the case at all. They'd say, look, all these operative facts are in South Dakota, that's where you have to go. The tribe talks about the tribal court order talks about in the findings of the judge and the state court judge, they talk about the consensual relationship, trying to find a Montana bootstrap to tie this case to, even though Montana doesn't apply because none of this happened on a reservation or on Indian trust ground. But they talk about the consensual relationship, and all they can point to is the father married a Native American who's enrolled in a tribe, and they say, well, that's a consensual relationship with the Indians. And the father, in addition to that, allowed his children to be enrolled in the tribe. And that's all that appeared in tribal court, nothing else. Nobody disputes there was more evidence than that in the tribal court. And then in the state court proceeding, when father was testifying, being called by lead counsel in this case, the father testified that, yes, the Sisseton tribe had given school supplies to his daughter, the one that's the subject of this action, on a couple of occasions. And even though she went to school in Sisseton, she lived within the town of Sisseton. And in addition to that, they brought out the fact that the children had received Indian health services. And frankly, that has nothing to do with the tribal government. The tribe doesn't offer that benefit. It's the federal government under the 42 United States Code and the Indian Health Provision laws that Indian Health Service provides those benefits. So there was no consensual relationship. That's nonsense. Then they talk about the ward of the court situation. And as we pointed out, that's nonsense. Then they've talked about the fact that this is an ICWA case, but if it's not an ICWA case, it's a comedy case. And if it's not a comedy case, it's a full faith and credit case. Under ICWA. There was no hearing that adequately handled the ICWA provisions under requiring full faith and credit. We can challenge jurisdiction. The only witness that appeared before the state court, as a matter of fact, when you read the transcript, the state court begged counsel for opponents, the tribe and the mother, begged them literally, do you have any evidence to offer me? I've got to hold a hearing. Do you have any evidence? They started to argue. The state court says, no, I don't want to hear argument. That's later. I have to make decisions. Do you have any evidence? And they had none. Co-counsel called the father as a witness. The father testified, I've never lived on an Indian reservation. Mother's always lived with me during the times pertinent to all of this, except when we were separated and divorced. The children have never lived on the reservation. They were living with me at the time this happened. And the judge, the trial court judge, just adopted the findings of the tribal court. There's no transcript from the tribal court. There isn't one. And there's no indication in the tribal court decision. As a matter of fact, when you look at the tribal judge's decision, which appears in the appellant's brief, when you look at the tribal court decision, if you'll turn to the back of the of our brief, on page 4 of the brief, on page 3 of the brief, it brings this whole case to a head. This is the tribal court talking. The real issue pertaining to jurisdiction is whether this court, SWO, can exercise jurisdiction over an abuse and neglect proceeding involving an Oyate member child residing with the father, a non-Indian in Sisseton, South Dakota. And then he goes on to say, now he gives his speech, South Dakota lies within the original boundaries of the Lake Traverse Reservation, but parts of it lie within the surplus lands that were sold off. And then he talks about the confusion of jurisdiction. Members of the court, the only confusion is with the tribal court in this case and what they foistered onto the state court with respect to that court order. The tribal judge said this child lived with the father in Sisseton. That's where this child was domiciled. Where's a case that holds that a child that's domiciled off the reservation with a parent that has no connection in any sensible way with the tribe, who's a non-Indian, can be subject to the jurisdiction of the tribal court? That South Dakota's got a responsibility to look out for its citizens of all colors, of all races, of all persuasions within the jurisdiction of the state of South Dakota.
Let me interrupt you.
Excuse me, Judge.
How did the tribal judge find, and I'm looking at his opinion here, that the mother is domiciled on the Lake Traverse Reservation on trust land?
Judge,
where did that come from?
Judge, he put it in his decision. The mother was never asked any questions like that. Neither was the father, except the father talked about his jurisdiction. The mother and the if this is going to be a full faith and credit case, we don't know for sure what it is because it doesn't fit within 1-1-25. It doesn't fit within the comedy. It doesn't fit within full. But if this is a full faith and credit case, Judge, we offered testimony before the state court because we could challenge under full faith and credit. We could raise the issues. We had the burden of proof with respect to the jurisdiction over the subject matter and the parties. And the mother, there was no testimony to refute what the father said, that they were all residents outside the reservation. There's not a single word. As a matter of fact, when the mother signed this complaint, she listed an address of someplace else. You can't find anything in this entire record, Judge, where the mother, why did the mother go to state court in April? She went in state court in April to try and change the custody. She was alleging neglect, among other things, whether, you know, it's all whether or not it's true is for another day. But the mother was alleging these things, and the reality of the situation is the tribal court says, I don't have any jurisdiction. You got a state court divorce. You got a state court custody. Go out there and do it. Why would the court do that? Why would the mother go there? And counsel for other opposing counsel tells the trial court, this is not a custody proceeding. They both make representations for that. The tribal judge, in the first order he signed, gave custody of this child to the mother. And then a day or two later, he said to a relative or to somebody else. He understood the significance of what he'd done. In addition to that, and I don't know, frankly, whether or not this court has accepted it, we got new pleadings served on us from tribal court recently, our client did, and we couldn't meet the 10-day rule because it's within the last 10 days we got them served on us by opposing counsel, where they're now seeking support payments from the father in tribal court under a placement in foster care. They're seeking support payments from the father with the child that happens to be with the mother. You can't be part of this. We can't all be part of this fraud that's being perpetrated. And I call it a figurative fraud, not a legal fraud, but we can't be part of that type of thing. With respect to the issue of 1-1-25, there's no dispute there wasn't any 1-1-25 hearing. They had, and their brief talks about how, as a matter of fact, at one point in the transcript before the trial court, opposing counsel said to the trial judge, Judge, this is a 1-1-25 proceeding under ICWA. That's their quote that they told the state court judge. They offered no evidence. 1-1-25 makes the moving party that wants recognition of that tribal court order carry the burden of proof. We're not arguing it is a 1-1-25. But if it is, like they told the trial court, they didn't carry their burden of proof. Under comedy, we were entitled to attack the jurisdiction. They defended the jurisdiction with argument and a tribal court order that was just, all you have to do is read it to see the significance of it. He talks about ward of the court. He talks about, the tribal judge talks about consensual relationship giving them jurisdiction. He talks
your
about,
time has expired, Mr. Jankel.
Pardon?
Time's up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Small, I understand you'll be speaking for 10 minutes and then Ms. Doherty for 10 minutes. Is that correct, sir? Okay, you have 10 minutes, Mr. Small.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. The briefs in this matter have, from the counsel for the father, have been terribly confusing, and I would like to be able to rein in the argument that you've just heard as specific as I can. I'm not sure that I can, but there are a couple of things that I would like to point out. Number one, the agreement that the tribal court judge depended upon is an agreement that's executed, even if it doesn't say so, it's authorized by 25 U.S.C. 1919. And 1919, which you didn't hear just now, is a authorization for states and tribes to enter into agreements regarding the care and custody of children, jurisdiction, including concurrent jurisdiction. Now, let's presume for a second that the effect of Dakota, the Dakota case, created a concurrent jurisdiction situation. We don't know that, and nobody really knows what the morass is that was left by the Dakota decision. But let's presume for a fact that it is concurrent jurisdiction. This agreement acknowledges that in writing and makes a determination that between the state and the tribe, this is where these cases will be heard. These kinds of agreements are entered into all over Indian country by states all over where there are Indian tribes within the state, whether it's Public Law 280 or whether it's a reservation that has no Public Law 280 jurisdiction and has its own exclusive jurisdiction. 1919 is a critical factor in this situation relative to the agreement. The federal law anticipated these kinds of situations, anticipated that there may be, the legislative history of the act, as you well know, anticipated that there may be situations where tribes were unable to provide these services and provide actually the judiciary necessary to do this. So what we have here is a situation that allows for an agreement here. Whether or not we agree that Dakota created concurrent jurisdiction, we have an agreement that creates concurrent jurisdiction under the authority of Congress. 1919 is incredibly clear about that. So relative to the agreement, I don't think that there's any question when it apportions to these kids that are in these three counties refuge in tribal court for these matters. I don't think that there's any question that that is a an arrangement of jurisdiction between the state and the tribe. True, it is a purchase of services. That's a necessary element of this because the state backed off, moved away from the provision of those services. The state actually got the better of the deal out of this because it wasn't spending those resources.
Absent the agreement, does the tribal court still have jurisdiction in this case?
I'm sorry?
Absent the agreement. Say the agreement never existed. Does the tribal court have jurisdiction in this case?
Then we have to turn to the question of the tribe's jurisdiction. It was summarily dismissed here. The tribal code says that they have jurisdiction over their members. They have jurisdiction over people that are not on the reservation that are in the military. Let's look at the situation with a tribal law. Did Dakota take away tribal jurisdiction? Did it cut off jurisdiction? Did Dakota affect 3 years later the ICWA application to this tribe? It didn't. It couldn't have. ICWA was passed after Dakota. Now, what we have here is a situation where you have a tribal member. Tribal law says that they maintain jurisdiction. The tribe maintains jurisdiction over children, minor children, as wards of the tribe. Someone came into tribal court about a tribal member and asked that the court do something because they felt the child was in danger. And the tribal court issued an order that determined that the child was a ward of the court. And
excuse me.
Determinations that normally flow from these kinds of things. So
excuse
the answer,
me
that's a
moment.
Long-winded answer to the question, yes, there is jurisdiction.
Justice Center has a question.
I'm sorry.
On that same line, though, as I read 380502 of the Tribal Code, I don't see anything in there that says they generally have jurisdiction over all children who are members. It says that they must be domiciled or residing or found upon the reservation. And as I understand the record here, these children never did.
That's correct, but I believe that the language of the Tribal Act is pretty clear relative to tribal children. What I was looking at was the Sistine-Wahpeton Sioux Tribe, now Oyate, shall retain original exclusive jurisdiction over children of wards of the tribe, notwithstanding residence or domicile, sufficient to determine all matters in relation to custody, supervision, care, and treatment.
Which that, section is that?
I'm sorry, that's in 380502. The language is very, very clear there relative to the kind of fact situation that we have here today.
Is that cited in your brief?
I'm sorry?
Is that cited in your brief, this 30?
Yes, it is.
Can you give me the page? Do you have it? That's fine. I'll find it.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I don't have it.
Let's discuss your ward of the court argument to give the court jurisdiction. Let's assume for a minute that the Indian tribe does not have jurisdiction. So someone comes in and the court does not have jurisdiction, and then they get a court order from the tribal court who doesn't have jurisdiction to say that the child is a ward of the court. Well, how can a court that doesn't have jurisdiction declare the child a ward of the court and then as a result get jurisdiction?
Well, number one, with all due respect, that didn't happen here, but obviously the import of your question would be that the court wouldn't be able to exercise jurisdiction. If a child from this city, a non-Indian child, were on the reservation and someone filed a petition on that child, obviously the domicile and the residence of the child is here. The tribal court order would be meaningless, but that does not fit into this fact situation.
But don't you have to be a ward of the court tribal court can take jurisdiction of the ward of the court?
No, not at all. The way the ICWA works is when it's I think that there was a misrepresentation here. When the action is filed, the court takes wardship of the court. The court wouldn't just walk around and take wardship of someone. When the petition is filed, the court determines that it has wardship or it doesn't have wardship of the child. This court determined that it did. It had no reason to issue an order otherwise because it wasn't even aware of this child.
But isn't the question whether or not they had jurisdiction to declare the child a ward of the court?
You don't need to be a ward of the court in order to implement your child welfare jurisdiction. The child doesn't need to be a ward of the court first before you exercise your jurisdiction. That's a reverse procedure it doesn't make sense. I'm sorry.
Okay. 2 minutes.
I'm sorry.
2 minutes left, right, sir.
The other question, if you will, is the question of 1125, and obviously the tribe came forward with this because the federal mandate is full faith and credit. And Congress has acted comprehensively in this matter, and every single state is to follow that. Every single state is to follow the procedures within there. And it says subject matter jurisdiction. The traditional inquiry in subject matter jurisdiction in federal law and in United States Supreme Court law, state law, is subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction and fraud when you're trying to determine this question. It doesn't include the discretionary deference kind of considerations that you would find in comedy. You have a lot of other considerations to make in a comedy scenario, and I would just like to point to a situation that a value conflict could keep this matter, whether if there wasn't even a jurisdictional question about the tribal court, if the tribal court made a decision that was based on the values and beliefs and ways of being of the tribe, and then the state court got the order, even if you found subject matter jurisdiction, you found due process, you found all the other factors, absence of fraud, and the state court said, this actually contravenes our public policy. This is not the way we look at this. You have someone that is expressing the generic white values of the people of South Dakota about a tribal court judge that has intimate knowledge of the ways of being, intergenerational tendencies, those kinds of things. And you have a collision there. And the Congress said, we will use full faith and credit. We will not use comedy. Full faith and credit has just two inquiries to make. It doesn't have the deference to make value judgments that a comedy judgment would have.
Your time has expired, Mr. Small.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Doherty, you have 10 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Danny Doherty, and I represent the mother in this case. And mother is asking this court to affirm the Fifth Circuit's finding that the tribal court order was valid under either preemptive ICWA full faith and credit or in the alternative under SDCL 1-1-25 South Dakota's comity statute. Just to clarify a few things that Mr. Janklow mentioned regarding the record. Also part of the record, and he talked about boot camp. I believe boot camp was also in Omaha, Nebraska, and also in the record about residences. When mother lived with father, they lived at times in Sisserton and at times in Aberdeen, and I believe that's in the trial court.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Janklow, if the father and the daughter had resided in Sioux Falls. Do you get the same result in tribal court that we have here because they happen to reside in Sisserton?
Your Honor, I do believe that is a possible outcome because wardship is a status determination over the child, and the tribe in its own code, as we 380502 right in the center, talks about making a child a ward of the tribal court and jurisdiction over their members. Membership is a status, wardship is a status. Those types of matters are status determination over tribal members, and that is therein lies the difference here, is the fact that we're dealing with a child tribal member. That, in combination with the overarching federal statute under ICWA, all those things, I do believe that the court, tribal court, could make that determination on a status basis. In addition,
Just to make sure I understand that, then, there's no dispute, then, that mother and children have never resided on trust land from this tribe. Is that correct?
That's correct. There is no residency dispute. There is a dispute over domicile, and arguably domicile is not, the findings are definitely not as clear. In my brief, I did...
Well, just a second, though. You can't get to domicile unless you've resided there. I mean, you can't be domiciled in a place that you've never been.
Oh, excuse me. The child was never domiciled on the reservation, but mother was. Before she married father, she lived on trust land on the reservation.
Where is that in the record? Was that testimony established? I didn't see where that was established any place.
I don't believe it was established on the trial court level, no.
Well, then we...
But the tribal court, sorry for the interruption, but the tribal court transcript is not in the record.
No, Your Honor.
So there's no reference in the record to support the fact that the mother even lived on that reservation before she went to Sisseton or before she went to Biloxi, Mississippi.
And, you know, the transcript at this time is in the custody of Gordon Nielsen. And I believe that we would like to have a copy of that, but that there has been some delay in getting that transcribed, even though he has custody and possession of that particular transcript.
The Circuit Court of the Fifth Judicial Circuit never had a copy of that transcript either, did he?
No, not at the time. They're
we hearing, only review what the
right.
trial court generally had to look at.
But even if this court chose not to follow the domicile line of argument, I believe we're on solid ground with the ward argument that the tribe could establish the child as a ward of the tribal court. And one other thing I'd like to point out, especially regarding the agreement that Mr. Jankel was so quick to...
Would you explain that a little bit more?
Certainly.
If you ignore the domicile or if you don't get past the domicile, how does the tribe make them a ward? What's under what?
The tribe's own code has provisions for making a child member a ward of the court, or an incompetent person, a ward of the tribal court.
That's and that does not code. Require domicile?
It does not. The tribe's code doesn't require it, nor does ICWA on its face. 1911A says specifically domicile or residence or ward. That is specifically in the disjunctive. And it's nonsensical, the arguments that ward is dependent on either residency or domicile. I believe Congress says what it meant when it wrote that statute in the disjunctive, and tribes were allowed to proceed under either of those three items outlined in 1911A. And as for the agreement that Mr. Jankel is so quick to discount, he says this is a contract that people enter contracts all the time with Lutheran Social Services or entities like that. I think what Mr. Jankel forgets is that this isn't an entity like Lutheran Social Services. This is a tribe. This is a sovereign nation. And the state entered into this agreement with that tribe.
Was just the Department of Social Services contracting. It was never approved by the legislature, was it?
No, it was not. But
does a state agency have a right to cede state jurisdiction?
The state agency has... The state agency itself has control over that area of the law regarding child protective services. And ICWA, a federal law, a preemptive federal law, allows for those type of agreements under Section 1919. Furthermore, just to touch a little bit briefly on even the comity analysis, which also kind of goes back to the full faith and credit analysis, although full faith and credit is less... is not quite as broad as what was reviewed under the comity analysis. But the court did consider testimony regarding each of the elements. And some of that testimony is just, it is legal argument as far as subject matter jurisdiction, especially regarding ICWA. ICWA preempts state law to the contrary. This court, in your concurring opinion, Justice Sabers, pointed that out, that ICWA is preemptive in finding in finding that in the in re NS that the clear and convincing standard was required under ICWA versus the beyond a reasonable doubt under ICWA was required over the clear and convincing of the state for termination of a parent's rights. And you described ICWA as preemptive, and that's because it is. It's a federal statute that governs this entire area. However, if, and that's the other thing I'd like to point out, and I think I pointed this out in my brief, is you have that whole analysis under the comity, and after that analysis, part two of SDCL 1-1-25 says then, even after all that review, the court may still recognize an ICWA order, and that flies in the face of ICWA preemption.
Now, if you prevail in this action, we affirm the Fifth Circuit trial court, would all further proceedings then regarding this child remain in tribal court?
No, because only the proceedings related to the abuse and neglect matter. Once that matter is resolved, then we would have to dispute custody in the state court. And everyone has recognized that from the beginning, that from my first intervention, mother's goal was she was concerned about the child in the care of the father because of the incident with the deceased child. And she certainly recognized there were two different ways to make sure that child was protected. And one was to try to get custody, and one was to follow along with what the tribe was doing regarding their member. And both actions and mother's involvement in both of those was just only about protection, but we do recognize that once the abuse and neglect matter is settled in tribal court, then we're back to a custody matter over in state court. And I don't believe...
Well, with abuse and neglect, actually, you could terminate parental rights. So you could in state court under an abuse and neglect proceeding. Are you saying that the tribe could proceed with this abuse and neglect and actually terminate the parental rights of the father?
I don't... the tribe could proceed to that level, but obviously the tribe's first goal would be reunification. And if there is any chance of reunification, then that would occur first. So I don't believe that... and then it would have to be based on appropriate findings. You have the worst-case scenario. What if you talk about... People are concerned about frauds. What if the tribe fraudulently decided to terminate this father's parental rights? Well, then, once again, you have the state court proceeding forward to review possibly an order that the father might dispute, much in the same line that we've already done here, and you have to check to make sure the tribe did that appropriately.
You have about 1 minute.
Okay. Let me touch briefly on the constitutional challenge. Father indicated that we were raising a constitutional challenge when we brought forth this argument. We didn't initially bring forth this argument. Mother did initially and then try, but this is not a constitutionality challenge. This is just preemption. And I think the case law in our brief is on point to that effect, that this is not a constitutionality challenge requiring notice to the Attorney General, that it is, in fact, a preemption argument. If the court chose to find the statute unconstitutional, which I know you do in very, very limited circumstances, that certainly, I think, would be appropriate with this particular statute as it's written. But we're interested in finding preemption, primarily and first. And we ask the court to affirm the Fifth Circuit in either regard, that this is preemptive federal law and it was done appropriately and with this agreement, or that SDCL 1-1-25 was met in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Doherty. Mr. Janklow, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to rebuttal, if I could, I'd like to first of all draw the court's attention to the federal statute in ICWA. We all talk about the ward section. Let me read the whole sentence. When an Indian child is a ward of the tribal court, the tribe shall retain jurisdiction, exclusive jurisdiction, notwithstanding the residence or domicile of the child. This court has held that whether or not ICWA applies at all depends on the moment the papers are filed with the tribal court. It's beyond dispute. The child was not a ward of the tribal court. As a matter of fact, The tribal judge was far more involved than counsel said in response to a question. The tribal judge ordered the tribal officials to file the pleadings in this case on behalf of the tribe. Mother filed her own petition where she was granted custody in her own name. But the tribal prosecutor was not filing these papers, and the judge went in and ordered that they file the papers. And then the state trial judge found that, well, the state would not look into the process and the procedures by which the tribal judge did their matters, and he didn't find fraud with respect to it. We don't argue whether or not there was fraud, but we find it interesting that these are the kinds of cases where the court decides what ought to be filed with the court as an action, as opposed to the individual parties. I would like to draw the court's attention to a case, unfortunately, none of us have cited it in our brief, and we weren't aware of it. But it's a South Dakota Supreme Court decision. It's the estate of Brianna Shea from 1999. And in it, Justice Gilbertson said, we have said, quote, the domicile of a minor child is that of the parent to whose custody it has been legally awarded. If a divorce or separation proceeding determines the custody of the child's domicile is that of the parent having custody. That is, regardless of whether the child lives with the legal custodian parent. And then going on later, no one can have more than one domicile. Domicile is established by physical presence in a place in connection with a certain state of mind concerning one intent to remain there. And frankly, that's the subject also of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that we all cite in our brief, the Holyfield decision, where the federal courts defined what domicile will mean under the Indian Child Welfare Act and said they wouldn't leave it to the states for all their definitions. And that's basically the definition the U.S. Supreme Court applied. But nothing could be more relevant to this case, nothing at all, than Justice Kornman's decision that he wrote with respect to the Children's Fund case involving the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe. And the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe was claiming jurisdiction over the Children's Fund, even though nothing they did had taken place on the reservation. And Justice Kornman said in his decision, in Hornell, which was the Crazy Horse case coming off of Rosebud, which the Court of Appeals said the Rosebud tribe had no jurisdiction, in Hornell, involving the previously quoted Rosebud Ordinance, the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit quoted from an order of this court, if providing a forum for its members would be sufficient reason to confer subject matter jurisdiction upon tribal courts when a tribal member is a party to a lawsuit, it follows that tribal courts would always have civil jurisdiction matter over non-Indians. There would have been no reason for the discussion in Montana regarding the broad general rule of no civil jurisdiction over non-Indians and the two narrow exceptions to that general rule. In an attempt to hoist the flag of tribal Hunkpati, which is the opposing party in the Christian Children's Fund case, Hunkpati's argument begs the question. It's an attempt to hoist the flag of tribal jurisdiction over the tribe's own bush steps.
Under our court rules, you made reference to a case that's not in your brief. We need 10 copies of that sent to the court.
Yes, sir. We will. We just became aware of it.
And also to opposing counsel.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
We will, Your Honor. Now, ICWA doesn't apply. Nobody will argue that this was a state court proceeding that got sent to the tribe, so you can forget B. Because it says, in a state court proceeding for foster care or termination of parental rights. And then it goes on. So it has to come under A. And A says you've got to be domiciled. If you're a child, domiciled, you've got to be a resident, or you have to be a ward of the tribal court for A to apply. And that's a jurisdictional issue for state government. This doesn't grant jurisdiction to tribal government. It says, and all the commentators agree with that, the subsection A provides the exclusive jurisdiction for the tribe under those factual circumstances. Montana doesn't apply with respect to this case. With respect to the question that was asked, is when a petition is filed, with respect to the tribal judge talking about the jurisdiction over non-members, the tribal judge was the attorney for the losing party in the Red Fox case that was before this court, where they tried to extend the jurisdiction over a non-Indian who lived in the town of McLaughlin within the boundaries of the Standing Rock Indian Reservation over a car accident where a Native American ran into his dead horse on the road. This was a person who had some contacts with the tribe, including the non-Indian had used the tribal courts before. In addition to that, in the Defender case, which we all cite in our briefs, that was a case that Judge Corman was on one side and the tribal judge, B.J. Jones, was on the other side. And once again, this court delineated the jurisdictional parameters that they get to deal with. In summary, let me just take it down to this. A lot of stuff's been thrown out on this case. If this doesn't apply, then this applies, and if this doesn't apply, then it's comity, it's not comity, it's full faith and credit, it's not full faith and credit, it's ICWA, it's not ICWA, it's minimum contacts, it's sufficient contracts, it's consensual. The fact of the matter is, there was no wardship that's subject of ICWA. There was no residency by this child or domicile by this child on the reservation. And there's no dispute. You can't find anything in the record, and they won't even allege the mother said in tribal court that she was a resident of the Sisseton-Wahpeton Reservation. And the judge just made a statement in a sentence about it. He didn't put any finding of fact or anything with it at the tribal level, and the state court took as its total evidence, other than the father and a couple other individuals' testimony on things, He accepted the court order of the tribal court. There's no agreement as to jurisdiction. All you have to do is read it. This isn't in the briefs. I negotiated the first contract with the Sisseton-Wahpeton Sioux Tribe, and I'm just saying that as a member of this bar. I represent that. I negotiated it years ago. Why? Because we had a state office of child protection, we had a tribal office of child protection, and there was no reason in both of us spending the money, so we contracted with them to perform all our services. I accept that, Your Honor.
All right.
I accept that, Your Honor.
Move on.
There's no agreement. You can't find the word jurisdiction in that agreement. And it says court of other competent jurisdiction. They sure didn't stand up here and tell you what that means in the agreement. If it's not tribal court, they have to go to a court of competent jurisdiction. State court is the court of competent jurisdiction in this case that they didn't go to. And they filed a petition because the tribal judge ordered them to in this case. In addition to that, there's no question that ICWA doesn't apply. 1-1-25 doesn't apply because it's an ICWA provision. And under comity, if they're going to seek South Dakota's comity statute for protection, then they have to follow 1-1-25. And all you have to do is examine the proceedings to know that absolutely didn't happen. The bottom line is, there was no jurisdiction over the father. There was no jurisdiction over the mother. There's no domicile by any of these parties legitimate on the reservation. And even if the mother was domiciled on the reservation, the father was the custodial parent for all times relevant in this case. Thank you very much, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. Before we recess, the court would note the presence of the following high schools today and wish to welcome them. White, Del Rapids, Sioux Falls, and Gorman, Wabay, and Augustana College. With that, we'll be in recess for 10 minutes.